You noble diggers all, stand up now, stand up now. You noble diggers all, stand up now. The wasteland to maintain, seen cavaliers by name, your digging does maintain, and persons all defame. Stand up now, stand up now. Your houses they pull down, stand up now, stand up now.
And welcome to Radio Free Canada. I'm your host, Kevin Annett, with my co-host, Ryan Gable, and welcome back. It's October 16th. Stand up, diggers all. That's a song from the English Civil War in the 1600s, the ancient and ongoing fight of the people to reclaim the earth against the lawyers, against the priests, against the gentry, that is, the rich. And that fight has never ended. As I like to quote from the poet W.H. Auden, evil is unspectacular and always human and shares our bed and eats at our table. Evil always has an address. And we're naming that address on Radio Free Canada here every week. We're naming the names and the addresses of the people who are crushing humanity. And for the last week, we've been looking at the disappeared of Canada, the disappeared of, especially in the west coast of Canada, Aboriginal people, but also many others. The reasons behind it, I really urge you to listen to last week's show on our archives at BBS Radio, where we interviewed Merv Ritchie, a journalist under fire now and facing imprisonment because he dared to name the name of the RCMP officer who has been accused of killing and imprisoning and torturing Aboriginal women in northern British Columbia in Terrace. Of course, tip of the much bigger iceberg. Today we're going to go into more of the background as to the history of the missing people, how and why Aboriginal people have been going missing for a long time in Canada and all over the world, who is responsible, how is it ongoing, and how we can stop it. And let me bring in Ryan now, because it's actually been 3 weeks since you've been on the air with me. Hi, Ryan. How are you doing?
Excellent, Kevin. I'm glad to be back.
Yeah, it's good to have you back. We always have a good dialogue together. And before we get into our theme today, I wanted to bring up a couple of news items we can talk about. One of them is a very exciting ongoing strike in America, and this, of course, touches on Canadians as well because the same conditions prevail here. There's been a strike of over 25,000 prisoners in the American prison system who, of course, under the Constitution are legal slaves under the 13th Amendment. It started in Alabama in Holman Prison on September 9th. It's now spread to 25,000, not just prisoners, but some of the guards in the prisons are coming out on strike, too, because of the bad conditions. And the Free Alabama Movement, a nonviolent organization involving an attempt to unionize prisoners, has been leading this strike. And what's really amazing, Ryan, I find about this is that they're raising issues not just of the slave labor conditions in the prisons, where prisoners are hired out to private companies sometimes for only 20 cents a day to work, in that way, but they're also addressing the bigger political question of how and why constitutionally are people in prison, 8 million Americans, considered slaves under the law. What? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, America has the highest incarceration rate per capita in the entire world, the last time I checked the statistics. And the federal government and a lot of the corporations that influence the federal government actually have agreements with some of the larger prison systems that they have a specific quota to meet. So millions of people are imprisoned every year unjustly, and a great deal of them, a great deal of the population that's imprisoned, are because of nonviolent drug offenses, which is where the war on drugs comes into play, putting people in prison. And you're absolutely right that it does create a slave labor force. And in some cases, people are paid less than even 20 cents a day. These corporations can then have that labor basically for free and then sell those products, make a massive profit. And whether that's done in China or it's done in the United States, we don't see it as much here in the United States. We always hear about other countries like China having suicide nets outside their factories for factory workers that work for Apple or clothing companies. But this happens right here in our own backyard, if you will. And I think it's the same thing with the missing people in Canada. I think a lot of people that live in Canada now, Canadians and even Americans, people go missing in America as well, think that this is something that is just confined to the past, when in fact it's something that is confined to the past, sure, but it's also present in the modern day. It happens today as well. It's an ongoing policy, whether that's for slave labor in prisons or people that are disappeared for other reasons, Kevin.
Absolutely. And, what's encouraging, Ryan, is this is getting a lot of play in the alternative media. There's a network called theantimedia.org. That's where I'm getting my information from. The Antimedia, A-N-T-I, theantimedia.org. And they are connected with this movement. It's called the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee. It's an attempt to actually unite prisoners in a permanent organization. And very encouraging. It's run by the what were called the Wobblies historically in America, the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, who really led the first free speech fights in America. They were the first union to ever bring blacks and white workers together. And they led a heroic struggle. Hundreds of them were deported, imprisoned, over, you know, around 1900, 1920, that period. So this is the thing. People are now continuing this and reaching out to the most oppressed, if you like, you know, the prisoners who have no legal rights under the law. So that's really encouraging. People can follow that if you go to theantimedia.org. Other issue, I don't want to dwell on this too much because I think the corporate media is really inflaming the whole conflict between America and Russia, but there is a lot of saber-rattling going on these days. Any news you have on that, Brian?
Yeah, quite a bit. I spent about an hour and a half of my life that I'll never get back watching the recent presidential debate, the second of the three presidential debates. And halfway through the debate, after the nonsense of videos about Donald Trump talking about women were discussed, there were maybe two or three national issues that were actually brought to the attention of the American people, albeit they weren't really discussed in that much detail. And in the process, Hillary Clinton started to make these claims against Russia that the Russians were responsible for hacking the Democratic National Convention, that the Russians were responsible if Donald Trump wins for him winning, and therefore there's a possibility that the election system, since they're claiming that it might be rigged because of Russian hackers, that if Donald Trump does win, they'll just revert the election to Hillary Clinton anyway. And in fact, the FBI in the United States and the Department of Homeland Security have both in the last 6 months issued warnings to state and local governments that the voting system is essentially rigged and that the case of Donald Trump becoming president or winning a district, let's say, will not be because anybody actually voted for him. And let's be clear, I'm not a Donald Trump supporter either. I don't support any of these people. But the DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, and FBI are claiming that if Donald Trump does win, it's only because the Russians hacked into our voting system. And that's something, that's a narrative that Hillary Clinton played out at the debate as well. But here's the thing that really irritates me, Kevin. Regardless if people follow politics, don't follow politics, they like somebody or don't like somebody, when Clinton was asked about Russia, just like any other Democratic or Republican politician, they always claim that the Russians are responsible recently in the media for hacking, et cetera, et cetera. When Donald Trump was asked, he said that he wanted to make peace with Russia. Now, I'm not fully understanding why anybody wants to go to war, let alone start another massive world war, even if it's just saber rattling. Where does this mentality come from? It's more than just elitism. Maybe these people actually believe that there are other enemies out there that constantly are on our doorsteps, that constantly want to hurt us. And yeah, maybe there is to a certain extent, but this hatred of Russia is at a fever pitch right now, and it's just absolutely baffling to me.
Well, it's nothing new, really. I mean, you always have to find an enemy to maintain the military-industrial system. Everybody knows that. A child can understand that. But, I mean, the recent stuff, I think, as we know, is all distraction. And I always keep coming back all the time to the quote from Aristotle when he said, "You cannot understand how any phenomenon will operate unless you first understand its nature." And this is what we need to do. Constantly be asking, well, what's the nature of the system we live under? It feeds off conflict. It requires conflict. You mentioned Homeland Security. The Department of Homeland Security, half their employees are not even government employees. They're private contractors that work for General Dynamics. General Dynamics is the biggest private corporation funding the U.S. or providing the U.S. government with military security hardware. They have a vested interest in keep everyone paranoid and afraid and under a police state regime. So it always comes down to money. And, you know, there's other things, too, at work, I'm sure. But, you know, as with the whole thing of the missing women and missing people in Canada and in America, it's about big bucks. And that's what we're going to try to analyze today as well.
Go ahead. Would you say that's the bottom line for the missing people in Canada over the decades and years? Is that something that is the primary cause? Is it money, or is there something else involved?
I think there's definitely something else involved, and we can talk about that. But I want to start at basics, and that is the fact that we know that Native people have been targeted for over 150 years in Western Canada because they sit on the most valuable resources in North America. Especially now, the hydroelectricity, the price of hydroelectricity, oil, uranium has gone through the roof. It's very profitable now. They've got to get those last lingering traditional people off their land. And when you look, and this is the point we made in, if you go to itccs.org, a couple of postings back, you'll see a memo we put out to the world governments about the continuity of genocide in Canada, as we call it. And two points in there is that the missing women, when you trace their bloodlines, they tend to come from, in their overwhelming majority, from the traditional matrilineal clan mothers who, under the Aboriginal system, designated who had what lands and resources. So you've got to wipe out that traditional hereditary leadership if you want to wipe out the memory of Native people and grab their lands and resources effectively. And Merv Ritchie last week talked about special deals going on between the British Columbia government, the Chinese corporations that want these resources, and various solid Native chiefs who are actually claiming to be the hereditary leaders of their people when they weren't, and they said they had the right to give away the title and everything to the land. So it's that old out-and-out theft going on and targeting anyone who stands in the way of it.
Another question I've always had is, and I believe there's actually a Native American proverb about this, who can actually buy, and who says that you can buy or sell land or water or trees or mountains? Right. It's just this absurd notion that anybody should be able to buy land or to buy water. It should be something that is just a given. It's something that belongs to everybody.
Well, there's two fundamentally different ways of looking at the world, and you just articulated the natural law, Ryan, that we all are born with. And that is, the natural law says nobody has any right, moral right to the earth than anyone else, and no one has any natural authority over anyone else. We're to share it as equals. And that's run through the life of every indigenous culture, including our people back in Europe and our indigenous traditions. And that's what was targeted by this corporatocracy that came out of Rome originally and forms the basis of the modern corporate state that really is running the planet. And the bottom line of the corporation is simply efficiency and productivity. Has nothing to do with human needs or nature or anything, and we're in a war against that system. People have to choose what side they are in that war.
Yes, in fact, I know the company Nestle just purchased a town's water supply in Ontario. This has happened quite a bit in the United States as well, in Maine and California, especially where there's droughts, where Nestle comes in and they can start pumping water. And I say it's legally, illegally, because they're not supposed to do it, but they get these special grants from the local and the federal government that says that Nestle has a right to the water and not the people that actually live there. So then Nestle pumps the water and sells it back to the people at a profit of hundreds and hundreds to thousands of percent, or in some cases takes the water, ships it overseas, and Nestle's been selling water in bottles to the Japanese, taking it from locations in California that are suffering severe droughts.
Well, exactly. And to bring this back to the theme today, I want to, show how this is occurring and why Native people are still in the way of this, this whole corporate machine. For people who are listening for the first time or who don't know a lot about the background on this, the background that to what we're going to be talking about today and on many shows can be found at murderbydecree.com. That's our recent book, Murder by Decree, The Crime of Genocide in Canada, and it paints the whole historical background using documentation and testimony showing the nature of genocide in Canada and really anywhere in the world involving Indigenous people. I want to flag that because when you read that book and you read that work, you'll see very clearly from the evidence that Native people have been in the crosshairs of the system from the very beginning. And their disappearances, the corporate media likes to compartmentalize these issues and say, well, we'll just focus on Aboriginal women who are going missing as if that's just a kind of separate issue. Well, Aboriginal women have been targeted for disappearances since the first white man landed on their land because they know that if you get rid of the women and the children, they're the keystone, the center of any vibrant culture. And you've got to target the women, because then the family system falls apart. That's, you know, that's clear from everything that's gone on. And so what I want to talk about first, Ryan, and we can dialogue about this, is we can't talk about disappearances today unless we look at how the disappearances have been happening right from the very beginning, including through the Indian residential school system, which was the main tool to finish off Native culture.
Well, has any of this been admitted by the mainstream media in Canada or the United States? And if it has been, what kind of whitewash, I would suppose, has been issued?
Well, you know, as people know, there was an incredible concealment of this truth that occurred in Canada between 2008 and just this last year. For 7 years, the government and the church is responsible for this mass genocide, conducted their own inquiry into themselves called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Now, you know, we've talked about this before ad infinitum, but there's a key point here, and that is the parties that perpetrate a crime cannot conduct an investigation of themselves. That's clear. It's also illegal. It's considered an obstruction of justice. And the way it played out was unbelievable. No Native person who had a statement involving the killing or the death of a child was allowed to have their statement entered as testimony. The evidence was struck clean of any reference to a capital crime. You know, the whole system was funded by the churches and government that did the crimes. And now they're walking around as if there's been some kind of genuine inquiry into this crime. So it's not surprising what's going on in Canada, but the very government and churches and system that did that cover-up are now pretending that they're going to look into disappeared Native women on the West Coast. I mean, it's unbelievable how what they feel they can get away with.
Historically, though, how has this gone down? How has this occurred historically? How have people gone missing?
Oh, well, first of all, you know, there's a structure set up. It's like in any system of genocide. They created a thing all in about a 10-year period. And again, this is covered in murderbydecree.com. You look at how in a 10-year period, the Canadian government, or really the Crown of England and the Vatican, brought in the Indian Act of Canada, which is still in effect. And it says that any Native person living on reserve is not a citizen. They're a ward of the state in perpetuity. That's the language. That means until the end of time. A ward of the state has no legal standing. It's like a continuation of the old terra nullius belief that the land of no one, there's actually no human beings wherever there aren't Christians, and specifically Catholics. That was the original papal doctrine, that if you weren't a Catholic, you didn't actually exist. You came into being when you were baptized into the Catholic religion, and then you could be legally enslaved. But before then, you didn't constitute any human being. That came from a very old Roman law that declared the lands nullus. Any lands the Romans were about to invade, they declared nullus or nullified. That is, the people there were just considered non-entities. So it's a very old thing in Western culture, but it permeates at every level of consciousness. Like when you're raised in Canada, Native people are literally invisible. You know, and it's the same in America. You were probably taught that when the pioneers arrived, they came to virgin land, virgin territory.
Oh, of course, of course. And the few people that did exist were savages and beasts and weren't humans, basically.
Right. So if you bring in the Indian Act, it means that still to this day, Natives don't have legal standing unless they give up their identity and their culture and their claim to their own land. You bring in the residential school system, which is misnamed. They were not schools. They were death camps. Half the children died, never came back. Deliberate sterilization laws and means of spreading disease among them, that was described constantly by eyewitnesses, that children were locked together in the same room as those who were sick. Check out our film on Repentant. It's documented. And so when you put that system together, and, you know, I mean, why are people surprised that the disappearances are still going on?
What exactly is, would you say, Kevin, responsible for these disappearances? We might say government, we might say corporations, but is there a way to pinpoint exactly who is responsible, maybe even provide names or entities?
Well, you know, it depends how close you want to get to the crime. We know the specific names of people. For example, we know that in terms of the cover-up plan, the RCMP have played a major role in this from the very beginning. I had personal contact with this after I lost my job with the United Church and started the campaign to expose these things back in 1995, 96. I was visited by several Mountie officers, Paul Wilms, Jerry Peters. These were officers in Vancouver. And I was told outright that it would be extremely hard on me if I tried to look into the whole question of children who had died in the residential schools. It was a direct threat. But one of the agencies that organized the Black Ops campaign to shut down any independent inquiry into the genocide and the missing children in the residential schools was a guy called Peter Montague. He's an inspector. He's retired now in Vancouver in E Division. He led the Black Ops campaign. He's the one who sent agents into our tribunal. He rigged kind of the first internet campaign against us. You know, we know the names of these people. The question is, who are they really working for? What's the big money behind them? And, of course, the difficulty is when you try to go to that level, it's like a mafia don. They have lots of layers of protection and buffer around them. So, in a way, you can never see the identity of who's doing the payment, but we do know what corporations are profiting. And if you go to itccs.org, in the latest posting, there's a leaflet that was put out at the University of British Columbia by some of our people out there. And it's entitled The Crime Scene Called the University of BC, UBC, Who and What is Buried on Our Campus. And it's a statement from a fellow called Les Gurin. Now, this is, again, described in murderbydecree.com. Les Gurin is a native man who worked on the grounds crew of the Musqueam Indian Reservation. It's just on the southern edge of the University of BC campus. And Les said that one night years ago, he saw Dave Picton, who's the brother of the convicted serial killer, Willie Picton. He saw Dave Picton bringing these bags to the Musqueam Reserve. Well, he dug up the bags later, Les Gurin did, and he found all these bones. Well, he took them to the Simon Fraser University Forensic Department, and it turns out they were the remains of women, young women in their 20s, mixed in with pig remains. Now, this was in the year 2004. This was 12 years ago. Les Gurin takes this evidence, and I've seen the evidence. I've got the report from SFU. I've seen the police report about it. He takes it to the police, and they not only don't investigate, they threaten him and say, you know, you will not tell anyone about this. It kind of blew away the whole lone gunman story, because in the Canadian media, this Willie Picton has been set up as the man who was killing all these women, and he went to jail and he did the time. Well, it turns out there was a lot more body dumping sites in Vancouver, including on the University of BC campus. Les Gurin claims there's three sites on the UBC campus where women are buried. Now, what's interesting is the UBC campus is under provincial authority, not Vancouver Police Department, but the RCMP. Now, if you're the RCMP and you've obviously made Native women go missing, it's a long tradition. A lot of Human Rights Watch, a group out of New York, has claimed, and it's in their February 2013 report, they say the RCMP are directly implicated in the disappearance of Native women on the West Coast, Canada. Now, if you're the RCMP and you want to get rid of bodies, what better place to do it than on a place like the UBC campus, which is under provincial jurisdiction? The cops can't go in there. And also, the very corporations that have an interest in getting rid of those Native women are big funders at UBC. We've named a couple of them. In the leaflet, they talk about, when you look at the UBC Board of Governors, Chairman Stuart Belkin, Timber West founding director. Timber West is the biggest logging company in the province and is constantly forcing Native people off their land to get their lumber. UBC Chancellor Lindsay Gordon, former CEO of HSBC Bank, which is the big drug cartel money laundering syndicate, already being fined $1 billion by the U.S. government for, you know, laundering money for the drug cartels. It goes on and on. So I mentioned that case of the UBC situation to show that there's this you know, unholy trinity of the cops, the corporations, the university, and all of these institutions have a vested interest in covering this stuff up.
So you'd obviously have to have that regardless of if the people were directly involved or were simply aiding and abetting in these crimes through whether they're payoffs or their threats. I mean, there'd have to be involvement from not just the churches and the corporations, but from the media, from local law enforcement, from federal law enforcement, even academia.
Well, exactly. And as a matter of fact, the same University Board of Governors is a guy called Michael Korenberg, who is the head of the what's called the Jim Pattison Media Conglomerate. Pattison Media owns most of the media out on the West Coast. So they've got it all sewed up in that sense. They can. There's been no reporting of any of the stuff, of course, in his corporate media. And so, you know, it comes down to the fact that the crime is right in our backyard. It's being done by the very institutions that the Canadian government is now working with to apparently investigate these missing women. So it's quite ludicrous. Let me just, now, Ryan, before we get into that, we're at the bottom of the hour already.
Yes, sir.
And we want to listen to a couple of these clips. I mean, people have been asking to hear more of the actual audio clips from our case against the Canadian genocide, from the court case in 2013. And we're going to play a couple of these now. These are testimonies of people that was included in the evidence given to the prosecution that found Canada guilty of genocide. And we'll be back after these audio clips.
Psychological terror was constantly used on children. As Catholic Cooper Island School survivor Belvy Brever describes how children were made to watch the body of her dead brother who was hanging and who were threatened in video exhibit 70.
You know what, sis? He says, I can't wait to get out of this hellhole. I'm going to tell everything. And then the phone went dead. People at resident at Cooper Island always listened to our phone calls and censored our letters back, you know, coming in and going out. So I, you know, like I was afraid for him, but I didn't think it was going to be as bad as it was. It turned out as bad as it was. 2 days later, we got a phone call saying that he hung himself. He committed suicide. But I never, ever, ever believed in my heart that he'd ever do that. They had them walk through the gym whilst Richard was still hanging and told them that it could happen to them.
The practice of housing the sick with the healthy that caused so many deaths continued throughout the history of the Indian residential schools, as eyewitnesses described. Video exhibits numbers 10, 11, and 12 are statements by Del Riley, incarcerated at the Mohawk Institute Anglican School in the 1950s, Del Marjani, an inmate at Cooper Island Catholic School during the 1950s, Virginia Baptiste of the St. Eugene School in the 1960s, and William Coombs, interned at St. Mary's Catholic School in the mid-1960s. All of them, at opposite ends of Canada, were made to sleep or play with children sick with tuberculosis.
My name is Del Riley. I'm a member of the Chippewa of the Thames. And I spent 5 years in the Canadian government calls it residential schools, but really these were prisoner of war camps. I was one in the one called the Mohawk Institute. When I originally came in, I had just gotten out of a sanatorium. Both my sister and I, we were admitted into here, and I just read her intake admission slip there. It said she had TB. Well, I must have had it. I had the same as she had because we were in the sanatorium together. My mother died there. And then they brought us here. So I don't know if we were used to infect people or not. I wouldn't know.
But you had tuberculosis when they admitted you to the Mush Hole, the residential school?
I couldn't guarantee that 100%, but I would have to say yes. Because you know, nobody was there to examine. But this was common practice at these residential schools where they brought in kids that were diseased. There was no filtration system within the school to properly circulate air or anything. So if one kid got sick, they all got sick.
Yeah. In the same room with people who had TB, they didn't separate us.
Then we were forced to play with them. The nuns made us play with those kids. We didn't want to get sick either, but they were forcing us to play with those kids. And also, they made some of them sleep with the other kids.
Many children that that weren't cooperative, and like myself, wasn't cooperative, and they were put into with the children who were sick with at the end of the dormitory. They kept the sickies there, the ones who were sick with tuberculosis, and they put me and my brother Ernie in with the ones who were sick because we wouldn't comply.
And we're back. This is all testimony you can find online at our International Tribunal in the Crimes of Church and State website, itccs.org. Go to the top of the masthead. You'll see the International Common Law Court of Justice, case number one. It's all there. Just go on there. Now, Ryan, one of the things, I mean, William, who was the last one to speak there, talked about being put among kids who were sick and dying with TB as punishment because they were uncooperative. And William subsequently was murdered in the St. Paul's Catholic Hospital in Vancouver. He's the one who saw Queen Elizabeth take the 10 children away from the Kamloops School October 10th, 1964. These kids were never seen again. William was going to come to England to give testimony. He died probably of lethal injection in the hospital, according to his partner, May. So this is what we're talking about when we say the crime just doesn't end and it can't be neatly dealt with by a bunch of words and money.
What other types of actions have Native people? Obviously, we heard the testimonies there at break. But what other kinds of actions have Native people taken to? I don't know if I'd say inform, alert, or to spread this information so that others know what happened and what continues to happen. Is it just some testimony and documentaries, or have there been other action groups?
There have been attempts, but you know, it's like if you think it's hard as an individual to go up at the system. As a Native person in Canada, you have everything stacked against you. If you even speak out, you are immediately come down on like a ton of bricks by your own people. I've encountered this so many times. The only Native people who consistently worked to bring this stuff out, from my experience, are those who are totally on the margins, who aren't living on reservations, who are, you know, I'm living on the street, basically. And if you're on reserve, it's a police state. The chief controls everything. That's where a lot of the drug trafficking and child trafficking goes on. Peter Yellowquill, who's a fairly regular guest on our show, described that at the Long Plains Reserve in Manitoba, how it's the chief, Dennis Meeches, and others who are bringing in the drugs, coming down on anyone who's trying to confront the government over things. So it's very difficult for a Native person in Canada to speak out without getting targeted. Six of our friends in Vancouver died as a result of getting involved in our campaign. And so the short answer is very little has been done because it's controlled by something called the Assembly of First Nations, which is an arm of the government. It's 600 self-appointed chiefs who say they represent all the natives in Canada. And from the very beginning, they opposed any investigation into the deaths of their own children, their own relatives into the residential schools. That was their price. They were assured lots of money from personal injury lawsuits if they shut up about the issue of death. And I know this, I have direct evidence of this, because about a year after I was fired from St. Andrew's United Church in Port Alberni for raising this stuff, there was a secret meeting there between two top officers of the United Church, Virginia Coleman and Marion Best, and they met with the top leadership of the New Chalmers Tribal Council. These were people who had been in my congregation, people like Sean Ablio's father. Sean Ablio used to be the head of the AFN in Ottawa. His father, the Ablio family, the Keeplers, the other top chiefs. And Marion Best and Virginia Coleman said, and I know this because my friend Bruce Gunn was present at the meeting. He's another United Church minister. Bruce told me that the two church leaders said to the Native men, we will give you settlements. We will give you compensation for the residential school crimes on two conditions. One, you have nothing to do with Kevin Annett and his investigations into the residential schools. And two, you never raise the issue of dead children. And they agreed. And that was the deal. It was in April 1996, and ever since then, nobody on the West Coast is allowed, if you're Native, you're not allowed to talk about the residential school murders. And if you do, you end up dead or isolated or worse. So that's the situation, and I know it's a long answer, but that's kind of the reality. It's hard for people in the non-Native world to understand because they have this kind of colonial notion that all Indians are one group. They're not. They're, you know, the Native leadership is as corrupt, if not more corrupt, than in the white world, and it's taking your life in your hands to take on these people?
Well, for those that have tried to speak out, it seems to be that if they have any type of voice at all, whether you're Native or you're white, it doesn't matter what your background is, you face this enormous opposition. It seems to be that you either have your voice heard for a short period of time and then are grossly discredited and essentially, you know, socially assassinated, maybe even physically assassinated, or you find yourself, you know, drinking yourself to death or taking drugs and just numbing yourself until the end of your life, or you end up taking a payout to get some type of what you might call, in quotations, justification, some type of reparations, and then you go on the rest of your life with your mouth closed. I mean, to me, I would propose the question, what exactly are the people that don't speak out, the ones that don't get the money, that don't get the payoff, what exactly are people so afraid of? And even the people that aren't speaking out from personal experience, what are others so afraid of that didn't go through any of this? What are people afraid of to even listen to these types of comments? Is it just this nationalist, I'm proud to be Canadian, I'm proud to be American, or is it something much deeper?
Well, I think for white people, definitely, it's like a will to disbelieve. Like, you can't believe, and I had difficulty. I mean, even though when I was a United Church minister, I couldn't believe at first that this church I'd been raised in, you know, where we always heard about the love of Jesus and we sent care packages to Haiti and all this stuff, how could they also be sterilizing and killing Native children? But you can't deny the evidence when it's in front of you, and then you have to make a choice. And when you make that choice and cross the line, your old world is gone forever. Your family, your friends, everybody turns against you. 99.9% of people turn against you. And, you know, it's frankly, Ryan, it's one of the reasons I wrote one of my recent books. It's called Truth Teller's Shield, a manual for whistleblowers, because in it I go through what you're going to face when you take that step and how to avoid the pitfalls in that. And so, you know, you can get that and the other books on Amazon.com. But what I want to say kind of generally about that is that, when you take the step as a white person, it's one thing. But when you take that step as a Native person, it usually means a death sentence. And I remember at one of our first healing circles in Vancouver, I asked exactly the question you just did, like, what is holding everybody back? And they had accepted me because they knew I had lost my kids in this divorce action. They knew the church had come down on me. So that gained a lot of credibility for me in the Native world. And they were really opening up to me. This was back in 96, 97. And one of the women stood up and said, we can't talk about it today because our own families are still involved in these crimes. She said, my own uncle raped me. He's still raping our relatives all the time. And so if you talk about it, it isn't some dead in the past issue. Your own family members today are doing the same things to one another. The incest rate, the child trafficking is enormous in the Native world, and it's Native people doing it to each other. So it's dangerous because it's still going on, and this is why we have to protect each other when we take this step. It isn't just some other issue. When you open this can of worms, you have to be willing to stand by the person to death. And if you're not willing to, there's no point getting involved in this because you know, I often think if you talk about these horrible crimes and don't take action, it's just a form of voyeurism. It's like, oh boy, what a thrill to hear about these things. But if you're not going to do anything about it, you're betraying those people who, like William, who stepped forward and risked everything to talk about the truth about what had happened to him.
So over time, we find that these types of crimes continue to this day. I think that's a huge red flag. Especially these are the same types of systems. You have to think after a while that this is an attitude, that this is a mentality that's passed down through generations. It's not something that was one generation. It's an idea, an ideology that's been passed down through multiple generations, through families, through governments, through corporations, et cetera, right? It has to be a cultural issue.
Yes, and also kind of an energetic issue, too. And, you asked about what else is behind these disappearances and that. You know, we've talked about the work of Sandra Fecht, and you've had her on the show. She's one of the only psychologists in Canada who's willing to look at satanic ritual abuse, or SRA, as a field of therapy and study. And she's facing a lot of opposition within the psychological community, in the counseling world, because of taking that stand, because so many people deny that SRA is a reality. But what is involved, and when I was just talking to her the other day again, she said, like, this is all about manipulating people's energy. And if you, we've talked before about how if you keep people in a state of perpetual fear, it's a form of, like, spiritual vampirism. You're feeding off people. Just like getting everyone worked up about, oh, World War III is coming between Putin and Obama. You know, it's a way to control populations. You often talk about that on the show. But in this case, it's got an added value, is that indigenous people, all of us at one point were indigenous, and we had a key to survival that the modern world is losing. We were in touch with the elemental forces of nature. Yes, my ancestors could shapeshift. They could turn invisible. They could control the forces of nature because they were part of it. And we're segmented and cut off now and from that, and that's how you create it and maintain a slave population. So it's really part of that whole bigger thing that we need to talk about more on the show, because it's in a way that's real, not just conspiratorial or imagined. This is very real stuff.
Sure, it absolutely is. And, I mean, how do we go about today? We make the realization, we may maybe in some regard for whatever we can in our own lives take responsibility, stop relying on others, but how do we stop these crimes in particular? I mean, we have evidence, we have witness testimony. Is there a way to stop these crimes in their current capacity with our current resources as individuals in our communities?
Well, you know, my immediate answer to that, always kind of at a heart level, is yes, we have to do it. But on a realistic level, we aren't equipped yet. Very few of us have reclaimed our own minds. Very few of us live in our heart mind, if you like, and know from that place of courage and resolve what needs to be done. We already know what needs to be done. We've shown a model for people through the common law court system. You can convene your own courts. You can elect your own community sheriffs to replace the police and the courts that are involved in these crimes. We can do all that. It's not so much the how, it's finding the spirit, the soul that will motivate us to do that. And that's not something you can do for anybody else. We each need to find that on our own. But one thing we all need to do, and this is bottom line, is we've got to cut ties with this vampiric system that's feeding off us. And it's as simple as going down to the local river or forest and sitting there and letting Mother Nature replenish you, turning off your electronic systems, getting back to who you are, reclaiming your soul and mind. You can't do anything unless you've taken that step. I learned that the hard way. And once you've done that, then reach out and start forming a genuine counterculture. And this is building all over the world. This counterculture is already there. You know, it goes by different names, but it's an attempt to reclaim ourselves and our world from this corporatocracy. So there's a lot of other things we can talk about, details, but I think without those essential first steps, it's pointless.
Yeah, no doubt about it, especially reclaiming our own minds, as you said. There's so many of us that are really programmed and conditioned to think that we must rely on authority, that we always ask the question, is it okay to do this? Is it legal? Is it lawful? Am I allowed to do that? Even when nobody's around, when nobody's looking. And that's a mentality that we have to rapidly get rid of, because that prevents us from taking that next step to do something that, whether or not you think or believe it's illegal, needs to be done.
Well, yeah, and you know, I think it's a very human thing to have that fear, but at the same time, I found that you do a shift at one point, and then you stop thinking, what's going to happen to me if I do this? And you start thinking, what's going to happen to that innocent child if I don't? What's going to happen to our next generation if we allow the world to continue to be plundered the way it is? You know, that's the mind we've got to start being in. And when you find there's an advantage in being battered, because you go through the fire. And in a way, unless you've gone through a lot of personal suffering and paid the price for your beliefs, you can't take that step. We have to be stripped clean of our attachments to our old world that really enslaved us. And I had the advantage of that happening to me. So in a way, I was a step ahead, because I had no way back into the system. I was being blocked. I couldn't retrain. I couldn't find any sustenance in the system. I had to find within myself and around me the way to continue, and there's no substitute for that. So I don't know. I think that's part of the lessons we learn, Ryan.
Well, regardless if we name people or we name a corporation, we name entities, groups, etc., as being responsible, or we take responsibility for our own lives and we start to reclaim our minds, are there other, I would say in quotations once again, forces that are behind these types of crimes. I know Sandra Fecht, who I have interviewed multiple times, she talks about different types of energetic forces, sort of like you referred to energy vampirism. But are there other types of forces from your understanding, from interviews that you've dealt with other people that have experienced these types of hardships and crimes that are behind them? Is it just human psychopathy, sociopathy, or is it something much deeper than that?
Definitely something deeper, and it's something, you know, if you want to use the word spiritual, ethereal, whatever, there's hidden forces behind this. I know for a fact, I've taken part in exorcisms as a minister. I know that what we encountered in those moments does not have a rational explanation, but it's some other reality. And you know at a gut level that's behind a lot of these crimes. It's what, you know, influencing people. But that requires a whole other discussion. And, you know, we should devote a few shows to that. And I should tell people now that I arranged with Sandra Fecht to actually come on Radio Free Canada on November 6th and 13th. And on those two Sundays, we're going to get into much more detail about her theories and practices of how to help SRA victims break out, but what they have to teach all of us about how we're all being influenced and controlled by this stuff. So there's that level. But at a more basic level, we have documented the activities of the Ninth Circle, and it's far more extensive than we originally realized. It isn't involving simply the Catholic Church and their long Jesuit-based history of child abduction and ritual torture and killing. It's a whole industry, just like human slavery is. It's an industry funded by big money, especially coming out of Europe during GATA and their banking system. And that's a whole other area of discussion, too. But in other words, it's an industry involved here. It isn't just some sicko up on the Highway of Tears in northern BC who likes to kill off Native women. He's being paid to, and he's in the employ of the corporations, including Chinese ones, especially Chinese ones that are infiltrating Canada so much now, the corporations that have a vested interest in making a lot of money off this, too.
Well, obviously, listening to radio shows like this can make a big difference, even if it's getting people to do a little bit of investigation themselves into these subjects. But if we spoke to somebody from Canada who did not know anything about this other than listening to a radio show of this nature, which they probably wouldn't be if they didn't know maybe a little bit about it, what can people do to really reclaim their minds and to be informed on these types of subjects, Kevin?
Well, like I say, you know, with most people it begins with education, but your mind's got to be open to be educated. And we find that, you know, I tried this for years, and it didn't work. You try to take our material and reach the general populace, and it just is rejected. Teachers will try to introduce our material on the genocide in Canada into the classrooms, and they get stopped immediately by the school board, by the principal. And it's you're reaching a minority of people right now, and you've got to reach and train those people. Part of what we talked about doing on this show is to hold actual online training workshops on the common law so that once you have the knowledge, you can do something with it. And I would recommend, in terms of the basic education, like I say, it's all documented in murderbydecree.com. The three books I've published this year are all complementary. Murder by Decree, The Crime of Genocide in Canada, Unrelenting Between Sodom and Zion, that tells the whole story of how the struggle came about over the last 20 years, and The Whistleblower's Manual. You can get all of those three on Amazon.com. Write to us, ITCCSoffice@gmail.com. And these are books that you need to get into your community and in the hands of people who are going to do something with it.
Absolutely, Kevin, no doubt about it. Why don't you go ahead and give out the website one more time? It's murderbydecree.com, right?
Murderbydecree.com. And again, this is very important to get into the hands of teachers and any student of Canadian history, because it's literally got everything in there that was censored out by the PRC.
Absolutely.
Murderbydecree.com. The tribunal website, itccs.org, it's a motherload of information and video clips, including testimonies of survivors of satanic ritual abuse and that. Of course, my email, hiddenfromhistory1@gmail.com. And I want to remind people, I know we've got about 3 minutes left here. Ryan, I really thank you for being back on. It's always good to have you here. I hope in the future we can get into more detail with these things. But next week, I'm trying to have Merv Ritchie back on, the journalist who's being targeted in British Columbia for bringing out the truth of what's really behind the disappearances of Native women, and to stop this new TRC cover-up that the Canadian government is trying now on the whole matter. So tune in next week for that. Any final announcements you have, Ryan, or things you want to say?
Yes, this coming Wednesday, you will be on my radio broadcast of The Secret Teachings. My show airs actually Saturdays, Sundays, and Wednesdays for 3 hours, same time at 12 a.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, so I'll be live this evening. But then this coming Wednesday, I cover a wide variety of subjects, literally hundreds and hundreds of subjects, focus on a lot of self-empowerment relating to health and other related subjects that are parallel to health. And we'll be talking about that quite a bit tonight. But also this Wednesday, we're going to have a discussion on some varied subjects relating to mythology and human perception. And then in the final part of that show, Kevin, you will join me for a bit of an update on your work and some of the other current events that you've been following and covering. So that will be this Wednesday, 9 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. You can find more information about that on my website, www.thesecretteachings.info. Thank you for having me on the program today, Kevin. It's been
Thank you, brother.
Very good show.
And we'll have you back. And just a final announcement, too. In terms of the program, we are looking into expanding to 2 hours. That could happen as early as December. We, in order to do that, it'll cost more. And I want some feedback from the listeners. If you want the program to expand to go to 2 hours, it's going to cost us over $400 a month. We need your donations. This is totally community-run. It's the kind of program where you'll hear people like Peter Yeliquil, one of the few Native leaders in Canada really going up against the system, genuine Indigenous Ogama, people like Merv Ritchie, a frontline journalist exposing these crimes. We can't bring these people on unless you support us. So please help us donate monthly, republicofkanata@gmail.com, K-A-N-A-T-A. The word means where the people sit as equals around the council fire. It's a Haudenosaunee word, and that's our vision of the world and of Kanata, our Republic of Kanata. Now that the Crown jurisdiction has been nullified, people. Now, we hope to hear from you next week and before then. Write to us, republicofkanata@gmail.com. Donate so we can go 2 hours as of December. And until next week, stay strong and stay clear, brothers and sisters. Thank you.
Can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long tongue liar.